And officially welcome everyone to today's internet seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'll be serving as a technical moderator in the background during our live broadcast, coming to you from EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. In just a moment, I'll turn it over to Michelle Mahoney from that same division here at EPA to open up our session. But before I do that, I would like to walk through a series of housekeeping items and instructions for our broadcast. Remember, everyone should be joining us for our Kluin Internet Seminar, Towards Sustainability of Passive Treatment in Legacy Mine Watersheds, Operational Performance and System Maintenance. All right. Eventually, my slides will advance forward. I apologize for the delay here, but I know this script because we do lots of them. So just remind everybody here that when you registered for the broadcasts, you would have been directed to something known as the seminar homepage. So the URL is shown at the top of this slide, and there's a sample page on the screen as well. I'll just remind everybody that seminar homepage is available from today forward. It's where you went to register, it's where you went to check in, and you can actually bookmark it and reference it later. There are tabs along the top of that seminar homepage, which will let you access information about the session, our speakers, download presentation materials, and review related resources. There's even an option to access our feedback form. So please be sure to bookmark this and reference the materials. Again, anyone looking for copies of the presentation material, you'll already find it posted on the webinar slide tab here on the seminar homepage. Now, our session today will be hosted live through Zoom webinar, which means you can participate using the free Zoom app or via a browser of your choice. If you have any problems connecting through Zoom, remember we have posted the materials. There is an optional call-in line that you may use, so you can simply follow along by the phone. Just know that there may be some interactive elements that you won't be able to participate in effectively if you are exclusively following along manually. So if you're having issues, please send an email to me and I'll be happy to work with you to troubleshoot and get you back on board to join us in the live application. Audio is available using your preferred device, so either your speakers or your headsets, or by an optional teleconference line using the Zoom controls located in the lower left. Remember, you have the options to adjust those settings, so if you're having problems with the online audio, please check your local settings first. Sometimes people find it helpful to disconnect from VPNs or remote networks to get a better quality broadcast. Everyone has been muted automatically, so there's no need to mute your mic. We've already taken care of that for you. Now, if you do have a question or comment or would like to report a technical issue, there are a couple of icons along the bottom of the screen in Zoom, and I'll ask everybody to turn their attention to the Q&A button at this time. So go ahead and click that Q&A button, and it should pop open a brand new window that you can move around on your screen as needed. I'll encourage you to leave that window open and have it available because that's how you'll send in your questions and comments for our speakers. You can also report tech issues at any time. Just to make sure you all are comfortable with that, please feel free to send in a quick greeting right now and just let our instructors know how excited you are to have them and how happy you are that we're offering today's session. And as I'm starting to see some of those messages come into the Q&A, I'll just remind everybody that you can send questions anonymously should you so choose. All right, and then a quick reminder, we have also disabled the meeting chat. So if you try to chat, it'll tell you that's been blocked. So that's where we focus your attention on the Q&A space. We do also have live closed captioning for those who need it. Please look for a CC button at the bottom and adjust the settings locally as needed in Zoom. Our session is being recorded, and I'll cover some important reminders at the very end of our broadcast today. So please stick with me until we close things out, because I'll explain how you can access that recording along with get a participation certificate based on your feedback in our session today. So with those very quick technical reminders, let's take a quick visual tour of the interface you'll be working with today. In the lower left, you'll have those audio controls to adjust the devices and levels in Zoom. You'll see the presentation content appear on the main portion of your screen, and then you'll find live speaker video or imagery on the right side as they're speaking. You have additional controls located in the upper right and along the top under the View and View Options menus in Zoom so that you can change the scale, go in and out of full screen, and adjust layouts on your end. And then as I highlighted, we have live closed captioning available using controls on the bottom of your screen. Unfortunately, I have no power to adjust your individual captioning settings. So if you want to turn them off, it's up to you to use the settings locally to disable it. And then as noted, that Q&A is available to send in your questions and comments at any time. And while there is a hand raise button, I kindly ask everybody refrain from using that feature unless we have time to use it at the very end. So if you have questions or comments, please keep them coming into the Q&A space at this time. All right, Michelle, I think that is the end of the technical reminders that I have for everyone. So at this time, I would like to turn the floor to Michelle Mahoney from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division to provide opening remarks for our session today. Michelle, you can feel free to start sharing your screen. All right, now Michelle, okay. I see the slides are starting to come up. And once you get into presentation mode.
Great, thank you so much, Jean. Appreciate the introduction. And thank you everyone for joining us today in this mining webinar series that we've been doing on Kluwen for quite a few years now. As many of you may know, and if you don't, I wanted to make sure that you're aware that we do have an area on Kluwen that focuses on cleanup as it relates to mining sites. And so this is where you can find that information. And on this webpage, you'll also be able to find where archives of previous webinars are located, and the one today will be put on here when it's made available. So I wanted to make sure that you knew how to access this page. And then for today, we're very excited to have our webinar topic on towards sustainability of passive treatment in legacy mining watersheds, operational performance and system maintenance. And we have two very great speakers for you today. We have Bob Nairn from the University of Oklahoma, who is going to share his experience working on the site, along with Brian Stanilla from the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality. So with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to them to share their experience with you.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. You should be able to see my slides, yes?
Can I get
verification? Thank you very much. I want to thank you all for being here today. I really appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of the work that we've been doing. Michelle explained the topic of the presentation. I will focus on some performance characteristics and talk a bit about system maintenance. I want to thank EPA and the Kluwen folks for inviting me here. And I'd like to begin by just making sure that folks are aware that this presentation was originally a paper that we submitted to the International Mine Water Association Congress in New Zealand in 2020. That meeting, of course, was postponed due to the global pandemic. But there is a manuscript available through the proceedings of that meeting. I'd like to acknowledge the co-authors on that paper, all of whom, except for the first and last, are or were students with the Center for Restoration of Ecosystems and Watersheds here at OU. So really a compilation of a number of years of work that were included in this manuscript. I'd also like to acknowledge all the partners that have played a role in the work that I'll present today, especially the private landowners on whose lands we work, our major funding partners, especially USEPA, the Department of Environmental Quality in Oklahoma, the Oklahoma Secretary of Environment, Secretary of Energy and Environment, and the Grand River Dam Authority. And then a number of other research collaborators, all of whom are represented by their logos here, who have played a role in the work that I'm going to present today. I know this seems like a long list, but I'm going to talk about a field site that we've been working at for nearly 25 years. So you can imagine there's been a lot of folks involved over those few decades. Lastly, I need to acknowledge all the students, the crew, the folks who have done this work. The data that I'll be presenting today were all generated by the members of my research lab, the Center for Restoration of Ecosystems and Watersheds, many of whom had gone on to faculty positions and consulting jobs elsewhere and still actively involved in mining reclamation and restoration. So fundamentally, the question we've been trying to answer for many years is, can natural infrastructure help restore anthropogenically disturbed watersheds? Essentially, can ecosystems and the processes and mechanisms that occur in ecosystems help fix man-made problems? In our particular case, working in mining impacted watersheds and specifically looking at water quality challenges. So I've divided up the presentation as we attempt to answer that question into five parts. I want to talk briefly about passive treatment and what that is, talk briefly about the particular field site that we've been working in at Tar Creek, and then really focus on operational performance, both from a water quality and a biogeochemical slash ecological perspective, and system maintenance, how we maintain these systems. And then I'll try to wrap that all up with some conclusions and a few points about some future work. So passive treatment, what are we talking about here? And I think most of the folks on the call may be very familiar, but I wanna make sure we're all on the same page. That photograph may look a little bit of fuzzy on the screen, and that's because it's about 30 years old. So that is a photograph of a passive system that I worked on in Western Pennsylvania in the late 1980s and early 1990s, a traditional old school design of a passive system. But these ideas have been around for a while. This is not something brand new. Matter of fact, the work originally began looking at natural sphagnum bogs in West Virginia and Ohio by a few authors that were very near mining discharges and noted that there was improvement in water quality. If you know about sphagnum moss, it is essentially has a very high cation exchange capacity. So yes, there was some water quality improvement, but it wasn't a long-term solution. But that idea, that seed that was planted led to the building of typha marsh constructed wetlands, cattail marshes. So you can obviously see in the photograph on the right that that was designed by an engineer because we've got very nice square rectangle, very straight lines of that wetland. But that work that continued on through the 1990s as authors in the Colorado Rockies, in Tennessee, and in the Northern Appalachians, eventually led to the idea of passive treatment systems, recognizing that, yes, constructed wetlands is one component, but there's a lot of other things that can go on in these systems. Open water ponds can play a role. Bioreactors can play a role. That work ultimately resulted in the publication of a Bureau of Mines information circular in 1994, Hedden et al., the passive treatment of coal mine drainage, that really in an analysis of a number of sites in the Northern Appalachians over a period in the late 80s and 90s, led to three major drivers that we still pay attention to today. We have to understand source chemistry and hydrology. Not all mine water is created equal. Each design is going to be site-specific. So we need to understand our source water chemistry and hydrology. If we do so, that can lead to the design of managed promotion of natural processes in different passive treatment units. Understand the chemistry, then design the mechanisms to improve that chemistry. We would size those systems then based upon area-adjusted mass loadings and removals. Not focused on concentration changes exclusively, not focused on concentration efficiencies, but rather on mass removal rates within the systems. So fundamentally, it comes down to two options. We've got the active option, we add chemicals, lots of labor, significant capital and O&M expense, but incredibly efficient. And the photograph, of course, is a site at Bunker Hill in Kellogg, Idaho, where this sort of approach has led to significant water quality improvement. It works, it's costly. The other option is passive. We're going to rely on those natural processes, hopefully be driven by non-fossil fuel-based energies. Still have some capital expense and some operation maintenance expense, but in a different order of magnitude. And this site is one of the sites I'll talk about today at the Tar Creek Superfund site near Commerce, Oklahoma. So let's introduce the site, Tar Creek. This is a historic mining site, a recent aerial photograph there. You can see the land disturbance is not inconsequential. It is part of the Tri-State Lead Zinc Mining District, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma. Mined pre-Civil War up until about the 1970s, mainly for the sulfides of lead and zinc, galena and sphalerite. These were massive underground workings. You can see the miner hanging on the wall in that photograph. These are very significant underground mining operations leading to substantial surface processing operations. So the photographs show one of the small mining communities, Pitcher, Oklahoma in the 1920s, surrounded by mining waste piles and a number of derricks over mine shafts. So the Galena, Joplin, and Pitcherfield folks are very proud of the fact that they mined the lead and zinc that helped win the First and Second World Wars, and they did do that. But that mining left an environmental legacy of four US EPA Superfund sites, two in Missouri, one in Kansas, and in Oklahoma, the Tar Creek site. Many legacy mining legacy-related problems within the Tar Creek site, about 2,500 acres of disturbed surface, many still open mine shafts and boreholes, millions of tons of waste materials, locally known as chat, several hundred acres of tailings impoundments, all undermined and at risk of collapse into the underground workings. But our focus today is on the water. About 99 million cubic meters, that's about 80,000 acre feet, of mine pool waters that are discharging to the surface at multiple locations under artesian head pressures. So I used to have a number here of 95 million. We recently did some mapping work of those underground void spaces, and we feel a lot more confident in that 99 number today. So this is a photograph of Tar Creek, one of the more famous locations, or more infamous locations, I might say, where we have artesian flows of iron-rich mine waters entering from the left. The orange water is coming out of an old borehole flowing into the creek. But on a rainy day, you also see runoff flows of metals contaminated water coming from the surface waste materials, that cloudiness you see there. But also notice that the stream itself is full of metal contaminated waste materials. So we have not only water quality impacts from outside the stream into the stream, we have materials within the channel itself replacing the native substrate that are also contributing to environmental degradation. Our team's been working at this site for about 25 years. So the map of the underground workings on the right-hand side in Oklahoma and Kansas, you can see the major surface drainages labeled as well. We focused our work on mine water artesian discharges, although we've worked in a number of different environmental media, and really focused with a goal towards passive treatment of those discharges. There have been many graduate student theses and undergraduate projects that have been done over the course of time that we've been working there. From an artesian discharge perspective, there are three areas where we see discharges, significant discharges from the mine pool to the surface waters. Douthat is that area that I just showed in the photograph, or the bridge at E40 Road. Beaver Creek is a small drainage into the Spring River that also has a significant number of discharges. And then a number of discharges on an unnamed tributary to Tar Creek near Commerce, Oklahoma. And we're going to focus there today. So we focused on the unnamed tributary. It was a piece of the pie that we felt comfortable early on being able to bite into, being able to chew on, and really being able to make a difference at. Two perennial discharges, the Mayor Ranch boreholes, and a number of collapse features that were originally called the Red Hole. The yellow dots in the aerial photograph are long-term mine pool discharge or surface water sampling locations. And you can see the great majority of them surround that Beaver Creek area, the Douthat area right smack dab in the middle of the mining district, and then near Commerce on the unnamed tributary. Those waters are very well characterized by our team. So net alkaline, more alkalinity than acidity in these cases, about 400 milligrams per liter as calcium carbonate equivalent. Suppressed pH typically in the high fives due to elevated PCO2. Elevated iron, zinc, lead, cadmium, arsenic, sulfate concentrations, like most hard rock mine waters. Given our geology, very hard waters, elevated calcium, magnesium, sodium, potassium, even manganese. And then measurable concentrations of a number of other trace elements in the mine water discharges. So we focused on looking at this statement back in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, a statement was made that these waters were irreversibly damaged by the past mining activities. And the question we're trying to answer is that still true 43 years later, or can we do something about it? So that's where we started, the conceptual design phase, about 10 years, 12 years of work, lots of pickup truck chemistry, bucket experiments in the field, column experiments, The end result of all that work was that we needed to target specific contaminants by specific mechanisms or processes. Some of them may be oxidative, some may be reductive, some may be more absorption or precipitation oriented. And to do so, to move to a field scale, we would then focus on those targeted mechanisms in specific process units that would be linked together sequentially. So essentially, we're creating the right conditions for biogeochemical solution. We're designing redox coupling. So oxidative iron removal in these waters, the reduced ferrous iron too, we want to get air into the water, oxygen into the water. And under those net alkaline conditions, we will precipitate an iron oxyhydroxide, an orange rust. For some of the trace metals, we're going to rely on a microbiological process, sulfate reduction, where we will create the right conditions with elevated trace metals and sulfate and providing an environment with a labile carbon source that can be used by those bacteria to create hydrogen sulfide and precipitate these trace metals as sulfides. And there are a series of other reactions, of course, that are also important, sorption exchange and carbonate precipitation among them. So let's look at it in the real world. This is the Southeast Commerce and Mayer Ranch site in 2003. You can see the unnamed tributary in the right-hand side of the photograph. Directly above that are the baseball and football fields for Commerce High School. We're right in the city of Commerce. The three yellow dots near Mayer Ranch are the borehole discharges. And near Southeast Commerce, you can see the red hole, the collapse feature that flowed the orange water, and directly north of that, what was locally called the green hole, a collapse feature that wasn't connected directly to the artesian flows, but had a significant elbow component. So, excuse me, we sampled those discharges as well as locations along the unnamed tributary, attempting to understand what effect they were having. Same photograph, but fast forwarded to 2021. Unnamed tributary on the right, Commerce High School on the to the north, the full-scale Mayer Ranch passive treatment system now in place in the lower part of the photograph, and the full-scale Southeast Commerce system in the upper side of the photograph. That, of course, means we have lots more sampling locations in our efforts, our research efforts to try and understand how the system works, how we can evaluate performance, and also what effect it's having on the receiving stream. So here are those two passive treatment systems in a bit more close-up photographs. Mayer Ranch was the first system in the entire Tri-State Mining District. It went online in November of 2008, funded through Clean Water Act 104B3 with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. This we considered our first attempt. It was a research grade site and therefore incorporates parallel treatment trains, 10 process units, 8 of which are in parallel. The first three, the oxidation pond, the surface flow wetlands, are promoting those oxidative reactions. The vertical flow bioreactors are, of course, promoting the reductive reactions. And then we're re-aerating and polishing those waters in the lower units prior to discharge. Southeast Commerce is the second full-scale system in the tri-state. It went online in 2017, funded by the Oklahoma Secretary of Energy and Environment through the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality. 4 process units based upon everything we learned at Mayer Ranch. An oxidation pond that incorporates some directional baffle curtains to increase retention times. Excuse me. A surface flow wetland, a vertical flow bioreactor, and a re-aeration and final polishing unit prior to the effluent. Flow rates at these sites are around 400 to 500 liters per minute, so 100 or more gallons per minute. Again, the focus and the big workhorses in the system are the oxidative processes that oxidize, hydrolyze, and precipitate iron. The upper left is that Mayer Ranch oxidation pond under construction. On the right, after it has begun to fill with iron oxides, we use off-grid aeration technologies. We are not tied into the grid, so solar and wind-powered aeration the demonstration in the bottom with Southeast Commerce. Those iron oxides are very of a very active surface area. We do see some trace metals absorption to the surfaces, and there's some potential there for some resource recovery that I may talk about at the end of the presentation. The other big workhorse are the reductive processes in the vertical flow bioreactor. So in the upper left, a layer of perforated pipe at the bottom of the system, then buried in gravel, a gravel layer, which then is then covered by an exogenous organic substrate. In our case, by a mushroom compost that is locally available, literally within about 2 miles of these field sites. Again, the idea is to promote under anaerobic conditions, bacterial sulfate reduction, the production of sulfide, and the precipitation of metal sulfides. Overall, we look at these as long-term ecological engineering field sites. We're applying natural infrastructure. It's an engineering with nature approach. The idea is to work with most Mother Nature's properties rather than trying to always fight against them. No fossil fuel use, solar and wind power and aeration. A brief note that these were federal or state funding that went to the university as demonstration projects, and then we put out a design bid competitively to the private sector and selected a contractor to actually do the engineering design and build the systems. In both cases, we've created systems or we've constructed ecologically engineered ecosystems, the water quality of which meets the receiving stream criteria. So that leads me to operational performance. How do these systems work? This is based upon comprehensive monthly to quarterly water quality and quantity characterization supported by lots of graduate student and undergraduate student research. There's kind of three take-home points. The evolution of the mine pool water chemical composition, things have changed when you're working at a site for over 2 decades. We do see some interesting trace metal dynamics I'll talk about. And I also want to talk about biogeochemical and ecological development of the passive treatment systems as ecosystems. So first of all, the evolution of the mine pool water. This is plotted zinc concentrations from the discharges at Mayer Ranch over time. And you will obviously see very quickly that those concentrations have been decreasing. As a matter of fact, they're decreasing in a statistically significant manner. And if we look on the right at the table, overall changes in source water chemistry and hydrology at this site are design data in the first column, the long-term data in the right column, some slight changes in pH and alkalinity, but statistically significant decreases in iron and zinc concentrations over time, changes in cadmium, some changes in lead, and significantly changes in the flow rates. So understanding those changes over time obviously will influence not only the performance of the system, but our maintenance commitments. Overall, the Mayer Ranch system has made significant changes in water quality. So this is very simply inflow and outflow data, increased pH to over 7, slight decrease in alkalinity due to the iron hydrolysis proton producing reactions. Iron and zinc both decreased to less than 1 mg/L when the long-term average of the final effluent. Lead, cadmium, and arsenic below our practical quantitation limits in the effluent in the long-term averages. A similar story at Southeast Commerce. Increase in pH, decrease in alkalinity, iron and zinc to less than 1 mg/L, arsenic, cadmium, and lead to less than the PQL. So if we look at what is actually going on in the system, in the oxidation pond, iron is oxidized and precipitated. That active surface area takes the arsenic out of solution as well. Iron removal occurs at a rate of about 20 grams per square meter per day. Interestingly enough, that is the design iron removal rate utilized in building the system. In the wetland cells, we see some additional iron polishing. In the VFBRs, the vertical flow bioreactors, trace metal removal based on a sulfate reduction rate of just less than 0.5 mole of sulfate per cubic meter per day of substrate. Our design was about 0.3. Our long-term average is about 0.45. Then in the re-aeration systems, increases in oxygen. The horizontal flow limestone beds, notice I don't have anything water quality wise there. And there's a good reason for that that I'll discuss in just a moment. And then the final polishing pond, increases in oxygen, decreases in total suspended solids. So another way to look at these data are to plot concentrations as relative to the inflow concentration, a CC max ratio. So note that for most of the contaminants of concern, we see immediate decreases within the system. But note that for sodium, which we don't expect to see any biogeochemical action on, we see no change. It acts as a conservative ion, which makes sense. What we're seeing is based upon the biogeochemical processes, not simple dilution or evapotranspiration. I should also note in this case, I felt the most honest way to plot our lead concentrations was to actually plot the date, those points for which we have data. But note, they only represent about a little less than 3% of the data that were above the PQL. Most of our lead concentrations at most of those locations are less than the PQM. So what's happening within those workhorses in our oxidation ponds? We've gone out and we've cored those oxidation ponds a number of times. The upper photograph on the right, those numbers you see are depths of accumulated wet sludge within the systems, typically higher near the inflows, lower near the outflows, a little lower in our surface flow wetlands. The core tubes in the bottom right show that from inflow to outflow, the accumulated material. We've got over a meter of accumulated material near the inflows. If we take those cores and we take them into the laboratory, analyze them, do something called scanning electron microscopy, we can see in the surface samples an amorphous ferrihydrite, essentially a freshly precipitated iron oxyhydroxide. But deeper in the cores, we begin to see crystallization to goethite. We are forming minerals deeper in the accumulated iron oxides in the oxidation ponds. In our vertical flow bioreactors, dry before flooding in the top photograph, flooded in the bottom, if we collect those substrates, do a sequential extraction, the exchangeable carbonate oxide, sulfide and residual fractions. For most of our metals, the great majority are in that sulfide fraction, the big purple bars in those bar graphs. We're forming sulfides based upon the sequential extractions. And if, again, we take those samples, do the SEM work, we can see well-developed zinc sulfide colloidal aggregates within the substrates. We even see iron 2 sulfide, FeS2, and framboidal pyrite deeper in our VFBR substrate. So again, over time, we are forming minerals within the passive treatment systems. At Southeast Commerce, we see some similar types of water quality improvement. Our iron oxidation, iron retention rate is a bit higher, 27 grams per square meter per day. You see, given, again, further iron removal in the surface flow wetland, trace metal removal in the vertical flow bioreactor, a little higher rate, about 0.6 moles of sulfate per cubic meter per day, and then reaeration in our final reaeration, final polishing unit. Notice that that 27, of course, is a bit greater than the 20 we saw at Mayer. And that's due to some design innovations we have at Southeast Commerce based upon what we learned at our other system. One of them is this photograph, a sulfide removal system through an activated carbon filter that I, if you have questions about, I'm willing to talk about, but I really want to focus on a solar powered aeration system. So that big panel, 3,200 watt solar panel, charges a bank of batteries, which runs a series of blowers that pushes air into our oxidation pond on the left and into our final polishing unit on the right, to add oxygen back into the water column. Those aerators we call FMAs or float mix aerators. The airline coming in from the right, feeds an airlift pipe that then lifts saturated water to the surface and spreads it over an aluminum circular plate that entrains more oxygen as it goes down into the water column. not only are we adding oxygen, but in the case of these particular mine waters, just as importantly, we're degassing carbon dioxide. These waters carry about a tenth of an atmosphere of carbon dioxide. When we degas CO2, there's a direct relationship between the partial pressures of carbon dioxide and pH. So as we drive out that PCO2, we see increases in pH that offset any proton production that we might see with iron hydrolysis. That is a very good thing. And of course, as pH goes up, the rate of iron oxidation increases. As a matter of fact, if we look at the role of those FMAs or float mix aerators here in the embayments between those directional baffle curtains, in the bottom figure with the aerator off and the aerator on, we see lesser iron concentrations when they're running. As a matter of fact, they increase the overall iron area-adjusted iron removal rate from 20 to 27 grams per square meter per day, or about 35%, which is not an inconsequential component. The aeration is important. We're accumulating solids in these systems. What about those solids? Those are some water quality data, but what about the solids? This is a plot of leachable cadmium concentrations through a number of different leach tests. TCLIPs or TCLPs, the RCRA prescribed the leachable procedure on the left, SPLP, synthetic precipitation leaching procedure in the middle, and then the field leach test, the USGS mining specific leach test on the right. So we sampled both at Meyer Ranch and Southeast Commerce. Total metal concentrations are very high, 500,000 milligram per kilogram iron, 6,000 milligram per kilogram zinc. But notice in the plot that we are well below the criteria for cadmium under TCLIP, well under the RCRA criteria. So therefore these would not be considered to be hazardous in this particular case. Same thing in our vertical flow bioreactor solids. So very similar study, TCLIPs, SPLPs, and FLTs. Again, total metal concentration, 65,000 milligrams per kilogram iron, 62,000 milligrams per kilogram zinc. But again, plotting lead in this particular case as an example, well below the TCLIP or RCRA criteria. Overall mass retains on an annual basis about 80,000 pounds of iron, 3,500 pounds of zinc in each system, and various amounts of lead and cadmium in the tens to hundreds of pounds within the systems. Overall, at Meyer Ranch, over 1 million pounds of iron, over 44,000 pounds of zinc, 500 pounds of lead, about 100 pounds of cadmium over the 13 years of operations. We expect to see similar things at Southeast Commerce as it continues operation. So in 1998, that is what the confluence with Meyer Ranch discharge and the Yunthing tributary looked like, bright orange water. By 2010, after the system went in, that is our final effluent pipe, very clear water. And in 2021, that's the confluence of the two where we see the significantly improved water quality. So it begs the question then, is this irreversibly damaged? Well, in addition to the water quality work, we've looked at some ecological metrics. So long-term water quality data collection, yes, but also long-term fish community analysis. So those five locations along the unnamed tributary that are labeled on the photograph, you see there are seining crew out on the right, seining fish. What have we seen since these systems went in place? We've seen recovery of the fish community. So those are data or photographs, excuse me, of fish collections in 2018. I'd like to focus on two of these sites, UTR, the most downstream location, and UTHS, one of the more upstream locations. So you look at UTR in the pre-construction phase from 2005 to 2007, we found about eight species of fish dominated by the Western mosquito fish, a relatively tolerant top minnow that was most common in that system. Few sunfish and other top minnow species and a few others, but eight species total. Meyer Ranch was built in 2008. The 2009 to 21 data not only show changes and increases in the catch per unit effort for most of the species that we originally had, but an additional number of species that were not present when we first, before we built the system, including largemouth bass, white and black crappie, a number of species of sunfish. At that upstream location, only four species of fish originally were captured. Post SEC PTS construction, we're up now to 16 species of fish, including a number of sunfish species. Again, the Brook Silversides, Blackie Bullhead Catfish, Golden Red Horse, a number of species, not only an increase in the number of species, but also an increase in simply the number of fish. So not only have we seen water quality improvement, we've seen changes in the fish community. And remember, we've done no in-stream habitat restoration. All we've done is improve source water quality that enters the stream. Mayor Ranch was implemented in 2008. We do have fish data pre and post construction, but we don't have anything. We didn't focus on any other wildlife, but anecdotally, in 2013, we had a return of North American beaver populations, Castor canadensis. So beaver recolonization was first noted in 2013, about 4 years or so after the system went online, and has become prevalent in the receiving stream since that time. They help us maintain some of our flow control structures. That is the beaver activity at one of our V-notch weirs. That is obviously a maintenance concern that we'll touch on. In 2022, a few years after we've seen the beaver come in, we just noted, and if you note the date on that wildlife camera photograph, that is February 1, 2022, we've seen North American river otter recolonization at our system. So that is the outflow of Mayor Ranch and documented river otter recolonization. So the systems improve water quality. They have an impact on the ecological metrics in the receiving stream, but we need to talk a bit about maintenance and about how we take care of those systems. The very first take-home point, if there is no other, is that low maintenance does not equal no maintenance. Yes, they are lower maintenance systems, but we still need to do some work. I like to divide those ideas into three general categories. First, kind of regular maintenance. We do it on a quarterly to annually basis. These are ecosystems. We will see accumulation of vegetation at some of the flow control structures. We need to remove that debris. We need to inspect our dikes and berms and embankments, especially if we have aquatic mammals like muskrats moving in. If we have any movable parts, valves and weir boards, we should exercise those. We might exclude aquatic mammals if they're going to cause us problems. The idea of a beaver deceiver, I'll talk about in a moment. And maybe most importantly, we should monitor process unit water surface elevations. We need to track those over time to kind of an early warning signal of any potential concerns we may see. Beavers have been, after they reestablished a concern at the site, they see their work there on the left-hand side. These are my grad students getting in at our weir structure, getting ready to put in what we call beaver deceiver, essentially hog wire systems that keep the beavers away from our flow measuring devices. That's our weir. Their structures work very well, at least initially, to keep our beavers from causing us problems. The second category of maintenance I would call periodic, every 2 to 3 years. If we have establishment of woody vegetation, willows, cottonwoods, we most likely want to address that. Maintain our conveyance structures. If we have airlines and diffusers, solar and wind powered aero supplies, air supplies, keep those maintained. If possible, gravity flush our vertical flow bioreactor components. Clean any pipes, monitor solids accumulation, and if necessary, revegetate our wetlands. We've had to do that. So on the left-hand side, and that's my students revegetating one of the wetland beds at Mayor Ranch. We had significant flooding events in 2019 that essentially choked off, killed our vegetation. We went back in harvested materials on site and replanted. On the right, we don't take a lot of pictures when we're doing maintenance, but that's our wildlife camera. I caught one of my grad students walking across the site with a chainsaw. In the bottom is something we've recently implemented, a new flow control device where we had essentially a open pipe discharge on these process units that began to accumulate solid materials over time. We replaced it with a skimmer, a floating skimmer, a piece of flexible pipe tied into a tight line pipe that then skims that water off the surface, maintaining the appropriate water level, but also maintaining conveyance, moving water through the system. The last type is rehabilitative maintenance every 5 to 10 years, replacing conveyance structures, perhaps removing accumulated iron oxyhydroxides, replacing the vertical flow bioreactor organic media, or maybe rejuvenating that media by flipping it or stirring it. We've done these two at the Mayer Ranch site. But I want to make sure I'm clear that all these rehabilitative maintenance mechanisms were driven by hydraulic problems, by hydraulic failures, not by any water quality or biogeochemical or microbiological or ecological concerns. It was our ability to put water through the system and keep water flowing. So we thought we were being smart at Mayer Ranch. We included lots of water level and lots of ability to control water levels and flows at Mayer Ranch. But what that really meant was lots of buried pipes, and lots of buried pipes can lead to problems. In addition to the buried pipes, we had lots of buried valves that would have to be exercised and utilized over time. Again, our idea was our ability to manipulate things. We wanted to have that ability, that flexibility and control. But what we saw in operation were some problems. So limited outflow and resulting elevated water surface levels in our oxidation pond, that's our hydraulics problem number one. I want to talk about two problems here. That was number one. The upper left photograph is the original open borehole drilled back in the 1900s. Very first thing we did was put control on that borehole in the lower left. Then we put it in a nice flow control box. You can see in 2009, nice discharge into our receiving sluiceway out in the initial oxidation pond. By 2017, that white box looked like this. So we were stacking water in the oxidation pond. We were backing up water. Luckily, we had implemented a water surface elevation monitoring program. Not only staff gauges that we could measure on every visually measure, but with data recording pressure transducers. So we had pressure transducers out, barometric corrections that collected near continuous water surface elevation data. The calculated head difference in the outflow structure of that system was about 5 centimeters. In reality, what we were seeing was about 70 or more centimeters. So we attributed that to a decrease in the cross-sectional area of conveyance, i.e. the pipe is clogged. Unclog it. So we ran sewer snakes, flexible augers through the pipe. We jet flushed, essentially taking a 3-inch trash pump and nozzling it down to a 1-inch orifice to force water through the pipe. We even rented a sewer cam and ran it through. So we tried snaking, jetting. The sewer cam showed us very cloudy water in the system, but no obstructions. So we produced lots of cloudy water with those amateur plumbing efforts. We saw no evidence of a clog. We would typically reestablish flow for a few days, but nearly an immediate response. So those are surface water levels on the right. You can see the bars are when we did those manual manipulations. Decreased water levels, but almost an immediate rebound. Our thought was that we had an airlock, that our pipes were not flat, and we were periodically forming an airlock in the pipe. So it was a clog, but it wasn't a solids clog. It was an airlock. Our solution, open up the conveyance structures. We replaced the piping with a 3-meter wired open channel outlet, feeding 2 inlet weir structures, the top photograph during construction, the bottom photograph during operation. We did leave all the existing infrastructure in place as redundancy. It took us about a week of downtime to do that, and it's worked ever since 2017 very well. Matter of fact, you can see in these aerial photographs, these Google Earth images in 2015, the elevated water levels in those process units. By 2021, the opening of the embayment, the outflow embayment structure, and really the reestablishment of vegetation under those lower water levels within the system. Hydraulics problem number two was in our vertical flow bioreactors. Limited vertical hydraulic conductivity. We were stacking water in the vertical flow bioreactors, which backed up water into the surface flow wetlands, which backed up water into the oxidation ponds. So our design freeboard was about 3 feet. We had about a design drop of about a foot below the inflow valves. This is from 2009. By 2017, those valves were underwater somewhere. We couldn't see them anymore, and we were stacking water within the system. As a short-term measure, we siphoned water from the surface of the vertical flow bioreactors downstream just to move water through the system. But it was obvious to us that we had a hydraulic conductivity concern. So we led a number of hydraulic conductivity experiments, tests, a field falling head test, a slug test, a modified single ring interferometer, and we even collected cores and brought them back to the lab. Our pre-construction data in the laboratory showed a vertical K of almost 5 meters a day. We could move a lot of water through that substrate. All of our four different methods showed really substantially decreased vertical K values in both the north and south vertical flow bioreactor at Bayer Ranch. So what do? Our solution, flip the substrate. So dewatered the system, went in with a mini excavator, turned over the substrate, took us about 10 days of downtime. The intact 9-year-old substrate was very prevalent below a degraded surface, as you can see in the upper left photograph. Very little loss of thickness of the substrate, very clean underdrained stone, indicating the problem was within the organic media, not in the stone or the piping system. However, we did see significantly degraded materials near some of the inflow structures. So very near the point of inflow, very fine material. We flipped that, mixed that, stirred that substrate. It looks like this after mixing. And when we go back and do our hydraulic conductivity evaluations, we have essentially restored our vertical K to very near the original value we measured pre-construction. These two major rehabilitative maintenance efforts each cost less than about $5,000. All work was completed with me and my graduate students. We estimate our annual O&M overall, excluding the science, the monitoring, at less than $20,000 a year for both of these systems. Okay, so conclusions and some potential future work. Again, on the left is our outflow structure. The image on the right is actually a bobcat family that's commonly at our outflows. So number one, properly designed and sized passive systems are demonstrated ecological engineering technology that improves mine water quality. I'm confident in saying that, and that water quality improvement has a direct influence on ecological metrics in the streams and riparian areas, in terms of the fish community, et cetera. Regular and sufficient monitoring and evaluation are critical. They are essential to evaluating long-term performance. These are not walk-away systems. Regular, periodic, and rehabilitative maintenance have to be included from the get-go, from project planning, design, and operation. We need to be thinking about that maintenance concern, those maintenance commitments from the very beginning. If we'd like to see widespread applicability of these technologies, we need to revisit some and revise some administrative and regulatory constraints on their implementation. But I would say they are a viable technology to address pollution problems in legacy mining watersheds. We plan on continuing work at Tar Creek. What comes next here? What are the What are the next things we want to do? Well, remember, we've only addressed one of those areas of artesian discharges. We've got two more. We've got Beaver Creek that has some seasonal flow rates. We've got Douthat that has seasonal but much larger flow rates. And if we look at the design drivers there, we've got some work done, but we've got a lot more work to do. So I'll point out that the concentrations of most of the contaminants of concern are lesser at Douthat and Beaver Creek, but the flow rates are not. So the mass loadings are going to be that much greater. However, these technologies are scalable, and passive treatment, we feel, is a viable alternative in both cases. We're also doing some innovative environmental monitoring work. In addition to getting out in the field and building our own catamarans to the top photograph there to do some sediment sampling, we're also flying drones, small unmanned aerial systems with multispectral sensors and using them to be able to predict water quality. So from the spectral signature, this is some data from one of my students that we're able to predict what water quality we would expect to see in the system based upon imagery that we generate with the drone. We're also thinking ahead. What do we do with all this stuff that accumulates? They're designed for mineral accumulation. They have a defined lifetime. Could we pump that material out as we're doing into this geotextile bag and accumulate that iron oxide? This is work following up on some great work that's been done by Bob Hedden and colleagues back in PA. And sure enough, if we take that dried iron oxide residual material and compare it to some local lake sediments, our ability to sorb phosphorus is orders of magnitude greater with the iron oxides than with local sediments. And so there's some substantial potential to maybe recover these materials and use them as a phosphorus absorption material. So I will close with this photograph of the Mayer Ranch outflow, the confluence into the unnamed tributary, and say thank you very much. As we look at this photograph of good water, I want to remind you that none of this would have been possible without the cooperation of private landowners and local stakeholders. And that's where Brian Stanila and the Oklahoma Department of Environmental Quality fit in helping us build those relationships, in developing the actual relationships with the landowners to be able to get this work done. So I'd like to turn it over to Brian at this time and let him tell you a little bit about that work.
Thanks, Bob. Let me load up here. Is that something everyone can see?
Everything looks great.
All right. Then let me see if I can move it off of the first screen here. And as Bob mentioned, he's, gone over in great detail some of the issues that we have with some of these passive treatment systems and how great they are and the issues that we're solving. And while most of his work has been, primarily technical, I'd like to focus a little bit on the administrative perspective of implementing these systems and just kind of, briefly go over some of our sources of funding, some of the contracting tools that we use to implement these systems, some legal tools that we use to implement these systems, and where appropriate, distinguish between remedial action and O&M. How are these systems funded, or how are these projects funded? Mayer Ranch was funded, in 2004, primarily through EPA, through the wetland program, through the 104B3 grant. The other portion of that project was funded under the Oklahoma Plan. The Oklahoma Plan was a legislative act passed by the legislatures in Oklahoma. And if you recall back to in Bob's presentation, you had seen a before and after, and you would have noticed the chat surface material next to Red Hole. A lot of the Oklahoma Plan addressed the surface restoration there, but it also added in kind of the 10% match that's needed for EPA's wetland program and for matching that grant. So that Oklahoma Plan was kind of jumping the gun a bit on EPA. EPA was in the process of establishing the operable Unit 4 record of decision, and the legislatures in Oklahoma and the state decided to kind of move ahead kind of before that was officially signed. And some, that was some of the work that was conducted under the Oklahoma plan. And that was for remedial action. So that was kind of the, for the design and construction of it. The operation and maintenance of Mayor Ranch, that's currently funded through our Petroleum Storage Tank Consolidation Act. That is essentially, think of that as like a gas tax. So for every gallon of gas that's sold, there's tax that's on that, that goes into a fund that's maintained by this legislature. And then there are several state agencies, you know, that get a little piece of that. And that's, you know, we get a little piece of that pie to fund operations and maintenance, not just at Mayor Ranch, but for operations and maintenance at all the Superfund sites in the state of Oklahoma, as well as that money provides us for matching 10% on any work that EPA is doing. So then Southeast Commerce was funded, again, the remedial action for Southeast Commerce funded in 2014 under the Oklahoma Secretary of Energy and Environment. That money came to us through OSEE, and then we kind of passed that money along through a contract with OU. One thing I do want to note, though, and I think it's a very unique scenario, is and very creative by EPA and the folks that were kind of getting this project lifted off the ground, is they allowed the cost for implementation and construction of the Southeast Commerce Passive Treatment System to count towards state match for any of their remedial work under our state Superfund contracts. So that allowed the state to kind of get the most bang for its buck. And it's something that, you know, should be, you know, very much noted, not just in terms of the funding, but how much more that allows us to do with the money that we do receive. And then again, O&M for Southeast Commerce is funded under the gas tax. And just, you know, just real briefly, I would say Bob's estimate between 10 and 20,000 for O&M costs are about accurate. Some of those O&M costs seem like they are higher, you know, after the initial construction, as we kind of figure out what problems there might be having. We had, you know, probably some a little additional costs there, but I would say that in terms of O&M for the systems, about 10 to 20,000 annually is about what it will cost. You know, if we have to do some larger work, then, you know, we'd up those costs, but that seems about right. For Southeast Commerce, to build that system, I think that was about $1.7 million to construct that system. And I believe Mayor Ranch was upper of $2 million. I wasn't around during 2004 to know how much that cost, but I believe that was in the 2 to 2.5 range to implement that system. But I think Bob might be able to correct me as I finish up here. So some of the contracting tools that we do to kind of, you know, employ to implement these systems, you know, first and foremost, we have to fund OU. You know, as Bob mentioned, you know, OU is the one that actually lets the bid for this work. You know, so we are acting kind of almost like a grant scenario, but we have a much, you know, kind of larger role than a normal grantee would have. And what we do is we enter one of the contracting tools that we use is an interagency agreement or contract. We have two of those right now, and one of them is for the remedial action and evaluation of Southeast Commerce. And then we have another one for specifically for operations and maintenance costs. And it's within those contracts that we, you know, are talking about the proposals, the budgets, the reporting, timeline, deliverables, all that kind of gets worked out within those interagency agreements and contracts. And I think that, you know, what I bolded and underlined and italicized probably, I think, the most important point that we have to make, you know, kind of on the administrative side of this, is, and that's in engaging our landowners. All of the locations that you saw and that Bob talked about, that is owned by private individuals. So without their participation, we don't have a project. We may have all the funding that we would like to have to implement these systems, but if we can't, you know, get a landowner to engage with us about putting one of these systems onto their property, then we can't construct one. You know, obviously compensation can increase our landowners' participation, and that's something that we've done in the past. And all of this is done through a memorandum of agreement or a memorandum of understanding with that particular landowner, you know, and to kind of set that framework up. You know, and just kind of as a side note, Southeast Commerce, you know, the landowner that we had that participated with us was surrounded on all sides by landowners who were not interested in participating with us. So, you know, in a way, you know, the result that you see from Southeast Commerce is very much kind of a result of the landowner participation that we did have. We had landowners to the north and the south and the east and the west that did not have interest in participating with us. And so we were constrained, you know, just geographically by the land that one particular landowner had. So you're thinking, well, why don't you just buy the land and skip the whole landowner process? Unfortunately, DEQ as an agency does not have the authority to purchase or own land. So we haven't been able to do that. So we have to be creative in the ways that we are able to, you know, provide compensation to the landowner. So, and then, you know, you think, well, maybe you just engage another agency that can do that. And so far, we haven't had a whole lot of luck convincing other agencies to purchase land on our behalf. So as we, you know, as we get into the implementation of the remedial action and kind of the administrative side of that, there isn't a whole lot of administrative work, at least from our side, that's going on through the final design and the construction and the implementation of the construction. I'd categorize it, you know, primarily as just normal project management work, you know, looking at invoices, if you got to do change orders, et cetera. But the big part of our, you know, our role administratively is after the construction, when we get to, you know, providing compensation to the landowner for using their land to build these systems. All this would be, of course, outlined in a memorandum of agreement or a memorandum of understanding. Previously, we'd essentially set up a per acre rate that we would compensate that landowner. We had all different types of metrics to determine how we would come up with a rate. You know, one of the metrics that we used was 30 years of the taxes of the land. You know, these systems, 30 years is important because that's kind of their design life. So we use that as a metric for determining a value. And there's also, you could use kind of the percent of the value of the land as compensation. There are all different types of additional metrics that were proposed. And, you know, with Southeast Commerce, we kind of just proposed these different scenarios with the landowner and essentially kind of let him decide which way he wanted to go with that. You know, and so, but after these things are constructed, you know, we want to protect them. And so, you know, we build a fence around there to try to keep people out as much as we can. And then we would survey that area. And then based upon that survey, would determine the rate or determine, you know, the acreage that we would be compensating that landowner. So this is kind of in terms of design and construction, this is kind of the administrative part that we are going through, at least on the DEQ side, to ensure that we have, you know, a happy landowner at the end of this. You know, but I think most importantly, beyond kind of the you know, the getting the landowner to, you know, participate with us, our second most kind of valuable tool that we use is this kind of long-term sustainability work. And what we're doing here is we are placing some type of notice on the property that allows us continued and unfettered access to do the work that we need to do. And the most recent case, we placed a conservation easement onto the Southeast Commerce Passive Treatment System. And this is something that was outlined and agreed to with the landowner. It does provide some kind of restrictive covenants within that easement. Things that we don't want the landowner to do. We don't want him to let his grandchildren to swim in there. We don't want them to go in there and try to fish it. But it also allows us to outline the things that we will do to kind of keep that property in good shape and allow us to continue to do all the things that Bob documented that are necessary to keep these systems up and going. And then we'd take that easement and then, file that within the county records. And that way, this easement goes along with the land. So that if we have a change in landowner or something like that, that we still have this easement in place and that any change in the landowner doesn't really impact our ability to continue to do this work. Other options that we might have that we haven't explored too much, we could file a notice of remediation or something similar that allows through Oklahoma statute that would be more restrictive upon the landowner, and it wouldn't be able to really outline too much of what we would like to do. So we liked the easement more recently, but then we also have uniform environmental covenants that we could also file. And, the goal here is just to make sure that we protect the not only the monetary investment, but the time and effort, the remedial investment that we're making. As Bob pointed out, there's so much effort that goes into maintaining these systems. And we want to make sure that we protect it through some type of legal tool. And these are the legal tools that we've, at least on the DEQ side, that have been tossed around as ways to protect that. So, these are kind of the most useful tools that we have to protect these systems. And, I'm going to wrap it up there because, there's not much administratively that we do beyond these kind of legal and contracting tools to move these projects forward. But what I do want to do is I want to acknowledge everyone at DEQ, all the project managers and staff that assisted in this project through the years. I want to acknowledge EPA through funding various forms, whether that be the wetland grant or allowing us to count the money that we spend as state match. They've been very supportive of our interest in doing these. And I think it's worth noting that passive treatment so far is not part of any remedy in any record of decision. Right now, we're in the process of evaluating operable unit 5, which is surface water and sediments. There's hope that passive treatment might find its way into that record of decision. Right now, we're in the remedial investigation feasibility study stage of operable unit 5. And we're encouraged that, demonstrating both Mayor Ranch and Southeast Commerce to EPA that these are solutions to some of our surface water problems. And then I'd like to also thank, Quapaw Nation, who is a hand-in-hand vital partner to cleaning up this site. Most of this land is on traditional tribal boundaries of the Quapaw Nation, and they are an active and vital partner as we move forward in trying to, determine what next steps we're going to take and what projects we're going to, go forward with. And then obviously, the kind of the brains of the operation behind us doing all this work, I want to thank OU crew and Bob Naren and all the students that I've had the opportunity to interact with over the years. They're very bright, they're very energetic, and they do a lot of great work to keep these systems moving and functional. And, you know, I just can't say enough about that, their group, and how much we enjoyed working alongside them on these projects. And we look forward to any continued collaboration and in all the future projects. You know, Bob mentioned something, that some work at Douthat, some work in Beaver Creek. Those are, you know, we're eyeing those as the next systems to address. But, you know, like I pointed out, I think the big thing that we need to do to get those things moving is begin to engage our landowners in a meaningful way and illustrate to them how important to the overall health of this site and health of that area, you know, implementing these systems is. So with that, I'll kind of wrap up and kick it over to Michelle to administer questions and answers.
Great. Thank you guys very much. I just want to let you know at the start of the presentation, we received another number of comments from participants that were stated that this presentation is very timely as they're making some decisions on treatment at their own mining cleanup projects. So I was very grateful for your presentation. I know you both talked about the costs related to, you know, the initial investment and monitoring and maintenance. We did get a question about that, so I didn't know if there was anything else you'd like to add about that other than what you already said.
Yeah, just one thing. I will say that Mayor Ranch engineering, design, and construction was $1.2 million.
Okay. I was off then.
A little bit, yeah. It was $1.2 million in the engineering design and in the construction of the system. Southeast Commerce was about $800,000 in design and construction, but there was an additional about $200,000 in removal of contaminated materials that were excavated. So that entire project cost was just about $1 million to get the system up and running. And I think Brian, you know, reiterated, our numbers, it does vary year to year, about $10,000 a year per system in regular O&M. There are obviously, when we do things like the flipping of the substrate, et cetera, that's going to add some cost on an annual basis.
Yeah. And then, you know, just the general monitoring of the systems, you know, that's added cost for students and analysis and things like that. So there are additional costs beyond just the nuts and bolts of maintaining the system to make sure that, you know, we got to have research and work that goes into understanding the problems that we're, you know, that we're having.
Great, thank you. So can you talk about what the total acreage is that was covered by the passive treatment systems that you described in your case studies?
Sure, yeah, May Ranch is just about 5 acres, including the interior berms. Wetted surface area is a little bit less than that, obviously. Southeast Commerce is about 3 acres.
Yeah.
So not inconsequential, 3-5 acres, but you know, we're not talking tens of acres in these particular cases either.
Okay, great. We received a comment from a participant that was found your presentation very interesting because they worked in Tar Creek in the late 90s. So they were glad to see how the project had moved forward. Another questioner asked if you could talk about the influent flow rates for the Mayor Ranch PTS.
Yeah, so the flow rates at both systems are between about 100 to 125 gallons a minute on average. Mayor Ranch long-term median flow rates, 111 GPM. The flow rate at Southeast Commerce is about 124 GPM long-term in the data we've collected already. Those in both cases, the flows are actually different than the design flows. We went down at Mayor Ranch in part because we had such a mess of boreholes and things that our pre-construction estimates, we erred conservatively at a higher number. At Southeast Commerce, it was the opposite. We actually are a little higher than our original design flows, but 100 to 125 GPM.
Great, thank you. So have you seen any evidence of depletion of labile carbon in your bioreactors? And is your experience that there's always enough fuel to do the sulfate reduction?
That's a great question. So we have looked at that periodically. Oh, you know, it's not something we do on a regular basis, but we've done it twice over the time at Mayer Ranch, where we've looked not only at total organic carbon, but at the fractionation of the labile fraction, or the amount of the labile fraction. That mushroom compost substrate that we use, and I think this was visually evident in some of the flipping photographs, it has actually not degraded substantially in mass. There's some areas where it did in the surface, but our labile carbon fraction looks like we've got, you know, our initial estimates were that we would have about 25 years worth of carbon given a sulfate reduction rate. We're still going pretty good. We feel that that's not inappropriate.
Okay, great. Another question is if you could describe the makeup of the VFBR substrate. And was there any consideration in using rock in the substrate to provide structure?
Another great question. So they're a little bit different. At Mayer Ranch, that is a 45% by volume mushroom compost, 45% by volume wood shavings as a longer term recalcitrant carbon source for longer life, trying to balance the labile fraction and the recalcitrant stuff that maintain a longer lifetime. And then about 10% manufactured sand in that particular system. At Southeast Commerce, we eliminated the sand component and went with a higher fraction of by volume of wood chips, about a 60-40 wood chip mushroom compost mix. We have another vertical flow bioreactor at a coal mine site in southeastern Oklahoma, where we did admix gravel to provide structure. That was certainly something that we discussed, but we did not do at either of these locations. That particular system, the addition of the gravel substrate didn't appear to make a whole lot of difference, at least in terms of hydraulic connectivity.
Okay, great, thank you. Lots of more comments about your excellent presentation. We did receive a question about the solar power, and is that supplying the needed power for your project?
Yeah, so I didn't get into it in detail. At Mayer Ranch, one of our aeration basins has a commercial off-the-shelf solar-powered re-aeration unit. It's essentially the same kind of small panels you may see at a golf course to re-aerate the water. And the other re-aeration basin at Mayer has a windmill actually from the aquaculture industry. So essentially, it's the same ones they use to re-aerate fish ponds. So in that case, we use kind of off-the-shelf technologies. They both worked. They both worked fine, but solar seemed to have a longer and more consistent effect on water quality improvement performance in terms of getting oxygen in the water. At Southeast Commerce, we built a custom design system. So that's a large solar panel, 3,200 watts, charging batteries and running not compressors as we did at Mayer, but blowers, where we're pushing air out into the water through some significant blowers. And the solar provides everything we need. Now, obviously, there are times of year where our batteries will die. If we have an extended couple weeks of winter weather, gray, if the panels get covered in snow, we'll burn up the power we've stored and we're not generating anymore. But as soon as that melts, as soon as we get the sun back out, we're going to recharge those batteries and we're going to continue re-aerating water.
Thank you. So how do your systems handle seasonal changes in rainfall, including large or short duration rain events?
So in both cases, the systems were designed to receive the upwelling artesian flowing discharge water, and only the water that would fall on the interior of the berms. So at Mayer Ranch, there's actually, I didn't talk about it, but there was an initial significant investment in a stormwater diversion. We moved stormwater around our system so we wouldn't deal with stormwater. Similar situation at Southeast Commerce, where the system is designed to take the upwelling mine water and the water that falls on the interiors of the berms, not any sort of stormwater, not any sort of storm-associated additional flows. So the freeboard in each system is designed for essentially a 100-year rainfall event. We have enough freeboard that what would fall directly on the system and on those interior berms, we would be able to maintain and contain within the system. We do see some seasonal variability in the artesian flow rates, but not a tremendous, not as much as you might think. This is a large interconnected mine pool. So that although there is some variability, there's not as much as you might think. We certainly see differences in water surface elevations within the process units based upon precipitation patterns.
Okay, great, thank you. And this question may be somewhat related. Just a participant was wondering if you looked at scaling the systems up to treat flows that are maybe 10 times the system influent.
Ryan and I are smiling at each other. We're doing that right now. So we're talking about the potential. There are some, we've been characterizing those discharges near Douthit, the big flows in the central part of the mining district. There's a lot of variability. It's kind of at a critical land surface mine pool interaction elevation, where we're just at the top of the mine pool where the land comes out. So there's a lot of seasonality in those flows, but they can be substantial. We've taken what we've learned at these sites and at least conceptually designed a system that is 10 times larger, that we feel would be effective in passive treatment. Now that you move from 3 or 5 acres to 20 or 30, obviously that comes with a different scale of operation and maintenance concerns. But it appears to be doable.
And just to kind of add on that, the big point over there is just trying to wrap our heads around how much volume is coming out at Douthit. We just can't measure it. It's immeasurable. So we got to figure out how to begin to measure it. We've been kind of throwing around ideas on how to get that done and potentially tie that work into some of the remedial work that we plan on doing around there soon. We're attempting to get there, but right now it's a challenge just to wrap our heads around how much is coming out there to then begin even to talk about sizing and moving water around.
Great, thank you. Do you have an estimate of what the residence time is needed for the reactions to occur?
Yeah, so the workhorse units, the big oxidation pond, those retention times at Mayer are about 7 days. At Southeast Commerce, it's a little longer. It's about 10 days. In our vertical flow bioreactors, the retention times are on the order of 3 to 4 days. Total retention time in the entire system on the order of 2 to 3 weeks.
And I just add, the baffle curtains that we had at Southeast Commerce due to kind of our land restrictions really, really helped our retention time in the oxidation pond. They're almost invaluable in allowing that system to kind of work without those baffle curtains. We would have had a much reduced retention time.
Okay, great. So we had a question of there was a particular reason why redundancy was not used in the South Commerce system components, while the Mayer Ranch used duplicates of several of the primary treatment components. It sounds like the O&M costs are similar. However, if significant O&M is needed at South Commerce components, the need to shut down the entire system seems likely, while Mayer Ranch could continue treatment through half of the system. And the questioner was just wondering if you had any thoughts or discussion on this.
The questioner is right on, right spot on. I mean, that's why we included the redundancy at Mayor Ranch. It was the first one we did. We wanted to have the ability to shut off a particular process unit and continue treatment. Unfortunately, I think some of the practical constraints that Brian talked about at Southeast Commerce were the drivers there. We simply didn't have the room to think about putting redundancy, multiple process units in place. As a matter of fact, I didn't talk about it, Brian didn't talk about it, but the first three process units at Southeast Commerce share a common water surface. And we used driven Z-piling to separate those process units rather than a berm, because we simply didn't want to take things out, take that area out of an effective treatment area. We drove Z-piling in between the wetland and the vertical flow bioreactor and the wetland and the oxidation pond. So it was very much a practical constraint on the available land area that drove that decision. We can take the system completely offline. That means putting the bad water back into the stream.
Yeah, and I think you know, that highlights what I was trying to talk about earlier, which is how important it is to engage our landowners and, you know, and sell the program, so to speak, to these landowners that are all around us. You know, unfortunately, we just ran into a scenario at Southeast Commerce where we just didn't have that level of participation with all the multiple landowners in the one area that we were trying to work. Obviously, at Mayor Ranch, that was, you know, there's 32 to 40 contiguous acres owned by the same person. So once that was worked out, it wasn't really an issue, but really, you know, there was a lot of design work and creativity that went into the Southeast Commerce the system because of our land constraints. You know, that's not to be underscored. There was a lot of Bob and Co. pulling their hair out trying to figure out how they're going to get this done.
Great, thank you. So are you monitoring hydrogen sulfide gas, or do you have any concerns with that?
Yeah, we do. We monitor hydrogen sulfide on a monthly basis. Typically, we find at Southeast Commerce, if there was one photograph that showed kind of a hydrogen sulfide, or excuse me, a odor control system box. Inside that container, we'll see elevated concentrations, but we monitor the ambient air as well as at a number of locations. Ambient air, we very seldom get a detectable hydrogen sulfide concentration. If we do, we're typically in the, you know, hundredths of a part per million in the air. Within the box, we can get elevated concentrations. And that's why at Southeast Commerce, we have an odor control system and a sulfide removal system. In both cases, at Mayor Ranch and Southeast Commerce, any particular odor concerns were manifested in the first few years of operation, and the system seemed to settle down a great deal as they mature.
Great, thanks. So you mentioned that you're using a mushroom compost that's available pretty close to the site. Can you talk about the source of the mushroom compost and why you chose it? Was it mainly because of the location?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the work that the Bureau of Mines did many, many years ago back in Pennsylvania, a lot of that work focused on mushroom compost because it was locally available. As it turns out, there is a very large mushroom farm, again, just a few miles away from these sites, an active mushroom operation. So when we first began our work there, we actually evaluated that compost. We evaluated locally available cattle manure, turkey and chicken manure, municipal lawn cuttings. We did a number of experiments looking at what would be the best substrate to promote these kinds of processes that we were interested in. And the laboratory work clearly indicated that the mushroom compost was our most effective organic substrate. We were just lucky that it was only 2 miles away.
Excellent. We had a question about if you're seeing any seasonal fluctuations in the effluent concentrations, and if so, are they significant?
our data over the last 13 years at Mayer, the last 5 years or so at Southeast Commerce, do not indicate any seasonal fluctuations in the final effluents of the system. We do see some seasonality in the vertical flow bioreactor effluent. We see greater performance, lesser metal concentrations in the warmer times of year. We're relying on a microbial process. It makes sense. And that those performance indicators kind of peter off in the very, very cold times of the year. However, there's enough redundancy. There's enough treatment area down gradient of the VFBR outflows that we don't see that manifested in the final effluents from the system.
Okay, great. We had a question about your study of the hydraulic conductivity at the Mayer Ranch bioreactor, where it showed that it was dramatically decreased over roughly an 8-year period. After fluffing the substrate, you saw a nearly complete restoration in the hydraulic conductivity in 2017. Has there been any further follow-up to see how well the hydraulic conductivity of the substrate has performed since the fluffing event in 2017?
Yeah, so we've not gone back in and collected cores to run the laboratory falling heads. We have not done any of the infiltrometer work. But we have begun what we think are the very beginnings of seeing a decrease in hydraulic conductivity in one of the vertical flow bioreactors. We're not at a point where we need to think about any sort of intervention, but it's certainly something that we're going to track. We have experience with this in some coal mining related vertical flow systems, where the time frame for intervention seems to exponentially decrease. So, for example, at one particular site, the first intervention occurred after about year 15. Things worked for about 15 years. Second one came in about another 5 years, and we needed to do it again in about another 3 years. And then eventually we needed to remove the substrate and start over. So we went in after 8 years in this particular case. We are now, I guess we're 4 years away from that. It is something that we're certainly well aware of and will track.
Great. So what was the carbon in the effluent? Did you see organic washout in terms of COD or VOD?
Yeah, we have a little bit of data. We don't typically monitor, at least today, we don't typically monitor COD and VOD. We did early on when the systems first came online. COD and VOD concentrations, I'd have to go back and look to give you a number. They were elevated, no doubt. And they were elevated not only in the VFBR outflow, but they were elevated in the final effluent. At least in the first growing season, especially. So again, I apologize. I don't know those numbers off the top of my head, but I know wastewater numbers. They were higher than wastewater numbers.
Thanks. Okay. Yes. Did you have something else to add, Bob?
I was just gonna say we don't continually monitor COD and BOD in the effluent, although we also see no evidence of elevated concentrations. When we saw it, you knew it was there. You get a different color of water and a different odor.
Great. And I guess this question just about applicability of your work to other sites. This participant wants to know if you can comment on any changes that would be required to implement this kind of system in a much colder climate. Where they have to sustain sub-freezing temperatures, say, for up to 3 months?
Yeah, I mean, there are some examples out there of similar sulfate reduction-driven systems that have been containerized and buried to address these temperature concerns. So I think there are good examples of the applicability of these technologies in a colder climate. We here in Oklahoma might get a frozen surface for a few days at a time in the winter. We never get very sustained cold for a long time, so we don't have personal experience with that. But I think there are good examples out there in Canada and in the in some northern parts of the United States, even in the Colorado Rockies.
Thank you. And I think that we'll end with this one last question. From a participant who is impressed that you, first of all, did this work at an MPL site. you know, without a CERCLA rod in sight. And that just was curious, you know, if EPA Superfund was involved with you on this project and if you could, you know, make any comments to that effect.
We have been involved with EPA Superfund. Those are open lines of communications from the very beginning. Certainly, much of our interaction goes through the state. I'll let Brian comment. I'll just say that from a funding perspective to the university, we have not received direct support from EPA Superfund.
Yeah, you know, we certainly, you know, communicate with EPA Region 6. This is, you know, where they were in their process of evaluating, you know, surface water issues was just not where we wanted to be in terms of implementing these systems. So, you know, that's why we kind of went ahead and tried to implement these systems and are implementing the systems not under a rod. And like I said, you know, earlier, we fully anticipate that these systems will be addressed under a record of decision in the future that might give us, you know, funding opportunities and some additional effort there. But, you know, we certainly, with the EPA match credits that we were getting for the money that we spent implementing the system, you know, we'd certainly report back to the project managers there about how things are going. You know, they are welcome to visit those sites anytime that they want. You know, they weren't really involved with any of the, I can't speak for Mayor Ranch, was at least for Southeast Commerce, they weren't really involved in any of the design or construction components of that. And Bob, I don't know about Mayor Ranch, how much they were involved with that.
There was certainly review and interaction with EPA ORD, who were hooked in with some of the Superfund folks. Our interaction was mainly with the water quality folks in Dallas at Region 6, not the Superfund folks in Dallas. But we did go through design reviews with EPA Cincinnati and EPA Superfund, Dallas Superfund.
Yeah, and you know, just kind of follow back up on that. We certainly view Region 6 and their remedial folks as, you know, as partners on this kind of work, you know, and hope that we can get, you know, future funding that where we're not creating kind of some type of workaround to get that funding moving forward, you know.
Well, great. Thank you. Yeah, that makes sense. And I really appreciate both of you taking the time today to present your work. I think it's very helpful to our participants. And we've received a lot of great, you know, comments and questions. And so I want to thank them for their participation also. And with that, I think, Jean, I'll turn it over to you to close us out for today.
All right. Thank you so very much, Michelle. Let me shift a couple of things around here on the screen. I'll walk through a few very important reminders before we close out today's live broadcast. So I am going to call up something here on my end. And as I'm doing that, I want to be sure to echo your thanks to all of our speakers who took time to share their expertise, along with the participants who joined us from all over the country and really engaged in a great Q&A session on our live broadcast today. Remember, we offer live events like this on the Cleanup Information Network every month, so I encourage you to visit us at cluin.org. You'll find a variety of ways to connect with us. You may be interested in signing up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which I send out on the first of each month and highlight free online technical sessions like today's webinar. So I encourage you to subscribe to that newsletter, and I'll just let everybody know the next one will come out on March 1st. The next reminder that I have for everyone is that copies of the presentation material have been posted on the seminar homepage. We highlighted that at the start of today's broadcast. You'll find the URL shown here at the very top, so you can take a quick snapshot and save that. It's also the same URL that we sent you in your reminder emails and confirmation messages, and that homepage will be available from today forward, so you can certainly bookmark it and reference it at a later time. There are tabs along the top where you can access information about our speakers, their slides, and then also other related resources and provide feedback for our live event today. I often get questions if we offer CEUs or PDHs. While I cannot issue those types of credit hours, I can provide you with a participation certificate if you fill out that feedback form and request the certificate. So when you visit the feedback form and check all the way at the very bottom for a checkbox certifying you were present for the entire session. As long as you fill out that form, check that box. As soon as you submit the form, you'll have an opportunity to download a participation certificate with details for the event, and we will also email a copy to you. Occasionally, though, those emails sometimes get lost in junk or spam filters, so I encourage you to save a copy from the screen as soon as you submit your feedback. If you had other parties joining at your location, you can send them the link to that feedback form and they can fill it out on their own, even though they didn't register, and they'll still get their own participation certificate for their own records. And as I highlighted at the very start of today's session, today's broadcast was recorded and will be automatically included in the Clue In podcast and archives online. We should have the recording up in approximately 1 week, and I will email you all when that recording is available. Please feel free to share that with others who you think will enjoy our session today. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's recorded webinar, we're glad that you stayed with us to the very end, and you too can get a participation certificate based off of your replay of today's recorded broadcast. So for those of you watching the online archive, take a look somewhere near the upper right above my video in the archived version. You should see a button to that feedback form. Again, you can click that, fill it out, check the box at the bottom, and still get a certificate based off your replay. So with that, I'll thank everybody again one more time for joining us, and we'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast.